Well, it's good to have you all back again after that nice meal we had. And thank the congregation again for all the kind hospitality and the good accommodations you're providing for us. Really appreciate it. Tonight we'll spend a little time talking about the Apocrypha. And as Samuel said before class, we've kind of gone over some of it already in other classes, and this class we talked a little bit about yesterday. So we'll look at it a little bit more closely. And here we have a list of the apocryphal books. And there are quite a few, but these are the ones that are kind of narrowed down, this list. And not all of these would necessarily be included in some of the sources we have. Apocryphal books were included in the Septuagint. I think we talked about that yesterday. They were included in early translations of the Bible. The Latin Vulgate in the 4th century included it. The 1611 version of the King James included it, but it was later taken out. So those facts cause us to ask, should we pay attention to the Apocrypha? Is it something that has scriptural validity? Are these inspired books? And everyone has to study that for themselves and come to a conclusion. Richard? Yeah, that's a good question. In the Roman Catholic Church calls them deuterocanonical, meaning another canon. So they're separate from the inspired canon, although they give them quite a bit of credence in the Roman Catholic Church. The King James Version kept them separate. The Vulgate kept them separate. So that's a very good point. They were kept separate. So it's sort of like even they weren't sure if they wanted to put them with the accepted canon or not, but yet they thought that they should be a part of the Bible. The Septuagint had the Apocrypha in it. And I don't know how it was arranged in the Septuagint. I did not see that. We will talk a little bit about the Dead Sea Scrolls that you brought up see something from that. This is a list here of them, and with the I'm not sure how they date these books, but these are the dates that one source gave for when they think these books were written. And we'll try to give you a little book review of each of these as we go through here. Now, there's also another classification of books called the Pseudepigrapha. There's something about that name that doesn't sound very nice. I guess it's the pig in it, but it just means writings that have been attributed to other people, but written by somebody else. And that's kind of what lends the confusion. Now, as far as PowerPoint goes, I didn't do this the typical way of PowerPoint. Let's see if we could see the whole list here. No, we can't even see the whole list here. I'm sorry, that's just the start of the list, see? And I didn't count up how many are in this list. It's an incredible list. I'll tell you what, I think I can show you the list this way. We'll go back to this format, and here goes the list. This is Pseudepigrapha. Yeah, let's see if Thomas is in the list. That's a good question. All right. Thomas. And here's what this kind of makes me think of. And I think they considered the Dead Sea Scrolls in a similar way. Those of you that have a library, what would happen if 1,000 years from now somebody excavated your library? Would they know which books were inspired and which books were religious books? They might be able to figure that out the way we write books now, but the way books were written back then, maybe it was a little harder to know the difference. I'm not sure. Let's see. We're not seeing Thomas, are we? There we go. All right, Thomas, Infancy Gospel of. Okay. Yes, I noticed that too. There's a lot of writings here. So, you can see the idea of trying to decide what should be in the canon and what should not be, and these were the ones that didn't make the cut, and for good reason, I think, as far as I know of these books. And that's what you always have to look at. This list made me think of the last chapter of John. What's the last thing John says in the Gospel of John? Yeah, that's right. Excellent. And then the last part of chapter 20 is a similar idea, many other things. These are written that you might believe, and that believing you might have life everlasting. That is such a good principle to always remember, that of the making of many books, there is no end. God's given us all the writings we need. He's given us 4 Gospels, and that believing you get life. What more do you want? There's nothing more to want. I've got everlasting life by believing what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote. I have everlasting life. So I don't. That's one reason these things, they're just, a lot of them are like curiosities. You know, like, I wonder what Pilate to Caesar is about. I wonder what that would be about. But as far as helping me spiritually, I don't know how much it's going to help me. I don't have much faith that it's going to build me up in my faith, but it might be. Yes, 2 Peter 1, thank you, Rex. God's given us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of His dear Son. So that's a good principle to keep in mind here. But as Tad said, there are some of the church fathers are in this list. And Rick Sparks talked to us about those the other night. We'll have one quote, I think, from Justin Martyr along these lines. But you can see this is a huge thing. You can see why I didn't do it the typical PowerPoint way, because I don't know how many slides that would have been, but I just put it on there. And it gives you an idea of the volume of stuff that's written. It's just incredible. All right. Go back to this now. And that's our list again. And I don't think all of these are included in the Latin Vulgate. I'm not sure if they were all included in the Catholic Bible or not. But here's something about the Dead Sea Scrolls to think about too, because Eric referred to these as very helpful in confirming the Old Testament for us. I thought this was interesting. There were about 11 or 12 caves that they found there in Qumran, there in the land of Israel. And the most manuscripts, the most books they found were the Psalms. And right behind was Deuteronomy. And then First Enoch. There were 25 of those, which is kind of interesting. And First Enoch is included in some of the apocryphal lists, although it was, I don't think it was on that other list, was it? No, it is not included on that list, but some people do put it there. Um, And the reason they put it there is because that has a similar quotation, a similar statement as you find in the book of Jude. And it's questionable in my mind whether or not that's where Jude got that from. And then they say also that that quotation in Jude about the dispute over the body of Moses, they think that's taken from one of these pseudo-pigraphal books. The Assumption of Moses, the Death of Moses. There were more than one book here about Moses, and I forgot which one it was. But anyway, that's another reason some people would include it in the Apocrypha. But not everybody includes that one. Genesis is in fourth place as far as number of books. Isaiah is right behind it. Jubilees, and I don't know much about the book of Jubilees, but there were several copies of that. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, the Minor Prophets, Daniel, Jeremiah, down to 1 and 2 Samuel. So those were the historical books, books that were found in the Dead Sea, in the caves at Qumran, which are called the Dead Sea Scrolls. And these were good because these went along with the Masoretic text that Richard referred to earlier. The Masoretic text is the one that the Jews basically accept as the right text for the Old Testament. The Septuagint varies from the Masoretic text in different places, and yet they go hand in hand. And the fact that Jesus quotes from the Septuagint and the apostles shows that even though there were some variations, Jesus apparently accepts it as the Word of God, which is an interesting thought, because in the long preface to the King James Version, keep in mind the King James translators were doing something very bold. They were giving another translation of the Bible. They were making it understandable to the people of the time. And the translation was opposed by the Roman Catholic Church. But they make an interesting statement in that preface, the long preface. They say that any translation is the Word of God, which sounds kind of odd, doesn't it? Especially when you hear people discuss translations and say, well, this translation's not good, or this is a great translation. It's interesting to think that the King James translators made that statement. Every translation is the Word of God. But Jesus apparently quotes from the Septuagint as well as the other apostles. I heard somebody criticize Stephen one time. Some of you may have heard him too. They criticized Stephen for using the Septuagint, and they think that's why the Jews got really mad at him. But I don't think that's true, but he may well have been quoting from the Septuagint, and I don't think he was wrong in doing so. Any comments on anything we've looked at so far? Yes. Yep, exactly right. Okay. How do I turn this light off? Do I hit the power switch? Okay. Oh. I guess we'll turn this light on. Okay, let's look at some things related now to the Apocrypha. First of all, let's go over some more information on the Septuagint. Since the Septuagint contains the Apocrypha, the Septuagint, as we talked about yesterday, is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and they apparently did not use the Masoretic text. And yet, it goes along with the Masoretic text very well. This translation was necessary because, as a result of the dispersion of the Jews and the Hellenization of the culture more and more were speaking Greek. And so parents trying to raise their children to know the Old Testament, their children weren't able to read Hebrew, so to have a Greek translation was going to be helpful for them when they lived, especially the ones that lived in the other parts of the world. Jews were surviving as strangers in a foreign land, strangers in a strange land, and this is kind of a legend, but it is something that Justin Martyr refers to when he writes as one of the early church fathers. He wrote this probably in the second century, probably about 150 AD. They say that King Ptolemy II, who we talked about yesterday, reigned from 285 to 246 BC, and he was the one supposedly that commissioned this translation. They wanted six elders from the 12 tribes of Israel, which added up to 72, and the Septuagint rounds it off to 70. So the 70. And here's Justin Martyr's account of this. Ptolemy, the king of Egypt, when he had built the library in Alexandria, and we talked about the great library of Alexandria, which was one of the seven wonders of the world. Well, by gathering books from every quarter had filled it, and then he learned that very ancient histories written in Hebrew happened to be carefully preserved. Wishing to know their contents, he sent for 70 wise men from Jerusalem, who were acquainted with both the Greek and Hebrew language, appointed them to translate the books, and that in freedom from all disturbance, they might the more speedily complete the translation. He ordered that there should be constructed, not in the city itself, but seven stadia off, where the pharos was built, and that, I think, is reference to the lighthouse, another seven wonder of the world, which is kind of cool. He ordered there be constructed as many little cots as there were translators. 72 cots. You know, you guys have a job. You got to translate the Old Testament. We got 72 cots here, you know, so you can rest. 72 cots. All right, so that each by himself, and he wanted each one to be by himself, which is interesting. He didn't want them to team up. He wanted you translate, you translate, you translate, all books. And of course, this is according to Justin Martyr. He enjoined upon those officers who are appointed to this duty to afford them all attendance, but prevent communication with one another, in order that the accuracy of the translation might be discernible even by their agreement. That's interesting, isn't it? To be on your own and translate, and then he's going to see if your translation agrees with everybody else's. And to them, that will be a sign that this is a from God, as well as ensuring accuracy. Nobody was biased or influenced by anybody else. So, when he had ascertained that the 70 men had not only given the same meaning, but had employed the same words, and had failed in agreement with one another not even to the extent of one word, but had written the same things and concerning the same things, he was struck with amazement and believed that the translation had been written by divine power, and perceived that the men were worthy of all honor as beloved of God, and with many gifts ordered them to return to their own countries, and having, as was natural, marveled at the books and concluded them to be divine, he consecrated them in that library. These things, you men of Greece, and this is Justin Martyr giving a lecture to the Greeks, these things, ye men of Greece, are no fable, nor do we narrate fictions, but we ourselves, having been in Alexandria, saw the remains of the little cots at the pharos still preserved. It's just a little humorous to me to see that picture in my mind. Saw the little cots there. See? There it is. But to Justin Martyr, apparently, this was proof that it must have been divinely inspired. The Septuagint then had a special place of importance to the early Christians. Vast majority of quotations, and I heard different numbers on the percentage, but this writer says the vast majority of quotations in the New Testament from the Old are taken from the Septuagint. I've always seen it is the most of them, but how much I'm not sure of. Taken from the Septuagint, not the Masoretic text, which forms our modern-day Old Testament. As there are significant differences between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text, the natural inclination is to believe the original Hebrew text instead of the Greek translation. However, biblical manuscripts found among the Dead Sea Scrolls indicate that the differences between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text are not necessarily because the Septuagint is a translation, but because the Septuagint is based on a different Hebrew source than the Masoretic text. If this is true, it may elevate the authoritative of the Septuagint in the eyes of biblical scholars. The early Christians may have been right all along in using the Septuagint. So that's something to consider, is that whether it's as accurate as the Masoretic text or not, it still was in use by Jesus and the apostles. So one writer says, one result of the Dead Sea Scrolls has been to give somewhat more authority to the Greek Septuagint, even though it is a translation. See, that's the problem. The Septuagint is a translation, and we don't know what source they translated from. So it's kind of the same criticism some people have for the King James Version, is that it's a translation, but they question that, not that the sources are uninspired, but they think that newer translations have better sources for their translation. Richard? Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's Hebrew, but I think there may have been some Aramaic in that too. I think there was some Aramaic in there. I think I read that earlier and I forgot. What's that? We saw a lot of it. Yeah, that's right. The Dead Sea Scrolls. Yeah. What did you say, Thomas?
That's
a good question. The Masoretic text was pretty carefully preserved, and they tried to keep, every time they'd copy and make new copies, they were just had real strict rules on trying to make sure it stayed the letter of the law. So I'm not sure how much that got into. It's a good question. I was telling Richard, I looked up Aramaic today. That would be a good thing for you to look up sometime. Look up Aramaic and see if you can figure out what Aramaic is. There's so many different kinds of Aramaic. There was the Chaldean Aramaic. There's the Aramaic they used in the time of Christ. There's Aramaic from this region, from this region. It's like language, you know. It's just kind of hard to pin it down. And so, yeah, it's just hard to pin it down. So, and that's why it's good. We've talked about this week, too, in different class, I think. We talked about the spirit of the law. That's what's going to keep you on track in all these things, is always look for the spirit of the law and try to avoid the argument that Eric was talking about today, that we're not supposed to strive about words. You know, if somebody tells you to do something, you could argue with them about the wording of how they said it, you know, but you know what they're saying to you. You know what they're telling you to do. You just want to be, you know, obtuse about it. And so you can pick on the words and say, well, you didn't say that right. Well, is this what you mean, or something like that? So look for the spirit in all of these things, whether it's the Masoretic text, which our translations are mostly based upon, or the whatever the source was for the Septuagint. I think do some of you have translations that will have in the margins Septuagint renders this? Yeah, that's good. And I always remember, that those of you that, in case you don't know, Septuagint is written in Roman letters LXX. Whenever you see LXX in your note, that's saying Septuagint. 70, yes. 70 translators. Yeah. Yeah. And, let's see. What date did he give here? Yeah. It was done under the order of King Ptolemy, who reigned from 285 to 246 B.C. So somewhere in that time frame, I don't know if we have an exact date, but somewhere between 285 and 246 years before Christ is when this was ordered. And it was technically 72 translators, but to round it down, round it off, they just made it 70. So always remember that in your notes. Whenever you see LXX, that's what it's referring to, is the Septuagint. Yeah. Good. Yeah.